Chapter 2. Building the Buddha Land. According to ancient Buddhist cosmology, space is infinite. And this infinite space is occupied by an infinite number of world systems, each existing on three planes: a plane of sensuous desire, a plane of pure form, and a formless plane. 1,000 such world systems make up one small universe. 1,000 small universes make up one middling universe. And 1,000 middling universes make up one great universe. We could go on, but this should be enough to establish an overall cosmological scale of things. If the living beings in a great universe are fortunate, they may, whether they know it or not, also be living in a Buddha land. A Buddha land is the sphere of spiritual influence of one particular Buddha, one supremely, perfectly enlightened being, who is responsible for the spiritual welfare of all the living beings in all the world systems within that great universe, or even within several great universes. So not only do we have an infinity of world systems, we also have this idea of an infinity of Buddhas, or at least, if that sounds too outrageous, a plurality, a very considerable plurality, of Buddhas. Not all great universes are fortunate enough to have a Buddha responsible for them. A Buddha is not some sort of god. He starts off as an ordinary human being, just like anybody else. What makes him extraordinary is his commitment to the spiritual life. He takes the Bodhisattva vow and follows the Bodhisattva path for thousands upon thousands of lives, pursuing his spiritual career within the world systems of the particular great universe for which he will one day have spiritual responsibility. In the course of his Bodhisattva career, he comes into contact with an enormous number of living beings whom he helps to the best of his ability. And eventually, after many, many lives of spiritual endeavour as a Bodhisattva, he becomes, in his last lifetime, a Buddha. The Mahayana tradition draws a distinction between a Buddha's sphere of knowledge, which is conterminous with the whole of conditioned existence, and his sphere of influence, his Buddha land, which is held to be limited to one or more great universes. A Buddha's knowledge is unlimited because it is an inner realization, not dependent on or manifested through any particular form, however subtle or refined. But his influence on other beings, who are by definition not on the same level, has to be exerted through a particular form, a particular medium, and that medium is limited. A human historical Buddha, a Nirmanakaya Buddha in the language of the Mahayana, has a physical body and physical senses, and his influence is communicated through those. The fact that he is embodied in that way limits his influence. It is not always clear, however, whether the Buddha, whose influence extends over so many worlds in the Mahayana Sutras, is a Nirmanakaya Buddha, a historical Buddha, or a Sambhogakaya Buddha, an archetypal Buddha, or a Buddha somewhere between the two. What is clear is that a Buddha whose influence extends over many, many worlds is not as limited in his influence as a Nirmanakaya Buddha in the narrowest sense, that is, a human historical Buddha. But however far the Buddha's influence extends, it has a limit, because it proceeds from a Buddha who is limited, that is, with regard to his outward form, whether that outward form belongs to a lower or a higher level. It is only the Dharmakaya which is unlimited, and it is therefore only on the level of the Dharmakaya that a Buddha's knowledge has no limit. When a Buddha wants to communicate, when he wants to influence beings, he has to come down a step or two in order to communicate through his human or archetypal personality with the beings on those lower levels. It is usually said that the Sambhogakaya is that aspect of the Buddha which communicates with the Bodhisattvas. But it is sometimes said that the Sambhogakaya has two levels. On one level, the Buddha communicates with advanced bodhisattvas, and on the other, he communicates with other Buddhas. If you think in terms of other Buddhas, there is division, there is limitation. But if all those divisions and limitations are removed, there is only the Dharmakaya. On that level, there is no question of communication. There is no question of influencing. There is only a non-dual knowledge or intuition. Because in respect of his supreme perfect enlightenment, one Buddha does not differ from another, in a sense, all Buddha lands are one Buddha land. The Mahayana does, however, distinguish between two kinds of Buddha land, pure and impure. An impure Buddha land is one in which all six realms of sentient existence are found, the realms of the gods, human beings, asuras or anti-gods, hungry ghosts, tormented beings, and animals. In an impure Buddha land, the basic necessities of life, food, clothing, and shelter, are harder to obtain. It is difficult to hear the Dharma, and difficult to come into contact with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. In short, it is a place where conditions are not at all conducive to spiritual development, where it is difficult for living beings to evolve towards enlightenment. Our own Buddha land, in which our Buddha gained enlightenment, is, and no doubt this will come as no surprise, an impure Buddha land. It is described in the Mahayana Sutras as a dirty, disagreeable, dangerous place, and bodhisattvas belonging to other Buddha lands are warned to be very careful when passing through it. A pure Buddha land is, of course, the exact opposite. Apart from Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it contains only gods and human beings. Food, clothing, and shelter appear spontaneously, without anyone having to work to produce them. The sound of the Dharma is everywhere, and everywhere you can come into contact with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Conditions are perfectly conducive to spiritual development. The best known example of a pure Buddha land is Sukhavati, the happy land, or land of bliss, which is the Buddha land of Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light. There are lengthy descriptions of its great beauty in the three Pure Land Sutras, which describe it entirely in terms of flashing jewels, brilliant lights, lotus flowers, music, and perfume. In the midst of Sukhavati, the Buddha Amitabha, golden in colour, he is elsewhere depicted as a red figure, sits on a magnificent lotus throne, flanked by his two chief bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara and Mahasthamaprapta. Beings appear in Sukhavati, as they do in other pure lands, by way of apparitional birth or spontaneous appearance, not as a result of sexual union. And having appeared, they have nothing to do but enjoy being in the presence of Amitabha and his bodhisattvas, listen to his teaching, and develop spiritually in accordance with it. The distinction between pure and impure Buddha lands is not, however, absolute. It is possible for a Buddha to transform an impure Buddha land into a pure Buddha land, and vice versa. Purifying a Buddha land is, in fact, equivalent to building one. Of course, one might well ask why a Buddha should want to transform a pure Buddha land into an impure one. One answer is that, as we shall see when we come to look at the first chapter of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, people find it very difficult to live in a pure Buddha land. Alternatively, it might be that a pure Buddha land will be less helpful spiritually to people who need to mature than an impure one. The Buddha might create an impure Buddha land because it suits certain people better. Both the question and the answers are based on the assumption that a Buddha literally creates a Buddha land, whether pure or impure, which we shall find is not the whole truth. But if one thinks in terms of the Buddha transforming a pure Buddha land into an impure one, it can only be as a skillful means for the sake of those beings who are not able to benefit, for one reason or another, from a perfectly pure Buddha land. At the same time, and again this is a point which will receive dramatic demonstration in the opening chapter of our text, it is said that, in the ultimate sense, all Buddha lands are pure. The Buddhas see them as pure, even if ordinary beings do not. It is also possible for a bodhisattva to create a pure Buddha land in the midst of an impure Buddha land. Vimalakirti's house, as described in Chapter 7 of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, is a pure Buddha land of this sort. A Buddha land is also known as a Buddha field, Buddha, etc., in Sanskrit. A field is, of course, something in which seeds are planted and grow, so the suggestion is that living beings, the inhabitants of the etc., are like plants to be cultivated, and that the Buddha is, so to speak, a great cosmic gardener. Indeed, the Mahayana texts repeatedly describe the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as maturing or ripening living beings, assisting them gradually, step by step, to spiritual perfection. This sort of imagery is found very early in the history of Buddhism. Shortly after his enlightenment, our Buddha, Shakyamuni, had a vision of all living beings as being just like lotus flowers at various stages of development, some sunk deep in the mud, others just beginning to rise up from it, some just buds, others half-open blossoms, and still others almost completely open. Similarly, in the White Lotus Sutra, the Buddha is compared to the sun shining down on all beings alike, and his Dharma, or teaching, to the rain. Living beings are, of course, like the trees, shrubs, and other plants, and when the rain falls and the sun shines, they all grow and flourish in their own way. The idea of the Buddha land, or Buddha field, uses the same kind of horticultural imagery. The building and purifying of the Buddha land is the main theme of the first chapter of the Vimalakirti Nidesha. The chapter begins, as we have seen, in Amrapali's garden, the park which Amrapali, the erstwhile courtesan, donated towards the end of her life to the Buddha and his disciples. The text tells us that the Buddha was staying there with a great gathering of his disciples. There were 8,000 monks, all in their yellow robes, shaven-headed, and presumably with their begging bowls ready. All of them were arhants, that is, they had gained enlightenment on their own individual account. In traditional Buddhist art, the arhant is usually represented as a wrinkled old man bowed down with age, sometimes with a staff. In addition, there were 32,000 bodhisattvas, who are, by contrast, traditionally depicted as beautiful young princes, 16 years of age. More than 50 of these bodhisattvas, including Manjushri and Maitreya, are mentioned by name. There are also many thousands of gods, Brahmas, Shakras, Lokapalas, Devas, and what we would regard as mythological beasts, beings of various different kinds, Nagas, Yakshas, Gandharvas, Asuras, Garudas, Kimnaras, and Maharagas, as well as ordinary monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. So, we are told, surrounded and venerated by these multitudes of many hundreds of thousands of living beings, and towering over them just as Sumeru, the king of mountains, looms high over the oceans, the Buddha shone, radiated, and glittered as he sat upon his magnificent lion throne. So this is the marvellous, extraordinary setting for the whole work, the Buddha preparing to teach the Dharma in the midst of this fantastic assembly. But before he can get started, he is interrupted by the arrival of the Bodhisattva Ratnakara coming from Vaishali, just a little way distant. he is accompanied by no fewer than 500 Lichavi youths, the Lichavis being the tribe of people whose capital was Vaishali, each carrying a parasol made of the seven precious substances. In Mahayana sutras, things are often made of these seven precious substances, usually enumerated as gold, silver, pearl, sapphire, ruby, emerald, and diamond. The list varies slightly in different texts. As soon as they arrive, the youths salute the Buddha, and then, carrying their 500 precious parasols, they walk round him 7 times, keeping him all the time on their right, an ancient Indian way of showing respect often mentioned in the Buddhist texts. Having circumambulated the Buddha in this way, they offer their parasols to him. And by his magical power, he proceeds to transform those 500 parasols into a single precious canopy so enormous that it covers the entire billion-world galaxy. We are told that the contents of the billion-world galaxy are reflected in the interior of this canopy, so that all those present can look up into it and see limitless suns, moons, and stars, limitless heavenly realms, limitless Mount Sumerus, limitless oceans and rivers, limitless villages and cities, limitless people, and limitless Buddhas teaching the Dharma. The voices of all these Buddhas teaching can be distinctly heard echoing in the interior of the canopy. Naturally, the assembly is astonished and delighted at this extraordinary vision, and they all bow down before the Buddha. Without suggesting that there is some allegorical point-by-point interpretation of this sequence of events to be attempted, we can perhaps lay down a few pointers as to their significance. The 500 parasols borne aloft, so brilliant and so colourful, surely represent the spiritual aspirations of those 500 Lichavi youths, in particular their urge or will towards supreme perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. In other words, the parasols represent the arisen bodhicitta. There are 500 youths, and therefore 500 parasols, so you might imagine that there will be 500 bodhicittas. But the fact that the parasols are all offered to the Buddha shows us that the spiritual aspirations of the youths all have one and the same object, supreme perfect enlightenment, as represented by the Buddha himself as he sits there. This shared aspiration acts as a unifying force. It means that their aspirations tend to converge, even to unite, to become one single aspiration. This is why the Buddha transforms the parasols into a single canopy. But what is that one single aspiration? What does the great canopy represent? As long as we don't take the expression too literally, as long as we take it poetically rather than dogmatically, we can think of it as representing what may be called the cosmic bodhicitta. And just as the entire billion-world galaxy is reflected in the canopy, the cosmic bodhicitta is aware of and responsive to the needs of all sentient beings. It is not collective, at the same time it is not individual in the ordinary sense. It belongs to a mysterious category for which we have as yet no word, a category which also includes the expression spiritual community. This is the possible significance of this incident at a very high level, but we can also explain it in more ordinary terms. It could signify that, to the extent that our spiritual aspirations have a common object, they will be united, and to the extent that they are united, they will be a force for good in the world. After the offerings of the parasols, the Bodhisattva Ratnakara praises the Buddha in a series of beautiful verses, a stuti or praising, or what we might call in English a hymn. It is intensely joyful and devotional, full of admiration and reverence for the Buddha. But at the same time, and this is one of the extraordinary features of these Mahayana hymns, in fact of the Mahayana generally, it is profoundly philosophical in content. It starts like this. Pure are your eyes, broad and beautiful, like the petals of a blue lotus. Pure is your thought, having discovered the supreme transcendence of all trances. Immeasurable is the ocean of your virtues, the accumulation of your good deeds. You affirm the path of peace. O great ascetic, obeisance to you. Then later we come to a verse which summarizes the philosophical paradox at the heart of the sutra. Ratnakara says, all these things arise dependently from causes, yet they are neither existent nor non-existent. Therein is neither ego, nor experiencer, nor doer. Yet no action, good or evil, loses its effects. Such is your teaching. At the conclusion of this hymn, Ratnakara asks the Buddha a question on behalf of the 500 Lichavi youths who have accompanied him. Having taken the Bodhisattva vow, they want the Buddha to explain to them the purification of the Buddha field of the Bodhisattvas. In other words, Ratnakara wants to know, and they want to know, how to set about building a Buddha land. The Buddha is quite pleased with this question, and he answers at some length. He says, to begin with, noble sons, a Buddha field of bodhisattvas is a field of living beings. Why so? A bodhisattva embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that he causes the development of living beings. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that living beings become disciplined. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that, through entrance into a Buddha field, living beings are introduced to the Buddha gnosis. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that, through entrance into that Buddha field, living beings increase their holy spiritual faculties. Why so? Noble son, a Buddha field of bodhisattvas springs from the aims of living beings. For example, Ratnakara, should one wish to build an empty space, one might go ahead in spite of the fact that it is not possible to build or adorn anything in empty space. In just the same way, should a bodhisattva, who knows full well that all things are like empty space, wish to build a Buddha field in order to develop living beings, he might go ahead, in spite of the fact that it is not possible to build or adorn a Buddha field in empty space. He goes on to say that a bodhisattva's Buddha field is a field of positive thought, a field of high resolve, a field of virtuous application, a field of the six perfections, a field of the four immeasurables, a field of the 37 aids to enlightenment, a field of the 10 precepts, and so on. And he concludes by saying of a bodhisattva, his virtuous application is tantamount to his high resolve. His high resolve is tantamount to his determination. His determination is tantamount to his practice. His practice is tantamount to his total dedication. His total dedication is tantamount to his liberative technique. His liberative technique is tantamount to his development of living beings. And his development of living beings is tantamount to the purity of his Buddha field. The purity of his Buddha field reflects the purity of living beings. The purity of the living beings reflects the purity of his gnosis. The purity of his gnosis reflects the purity of his doctrine. The purity of his doctrine reflects the purity of his transcendental practice. And the purity of his transcendental practice reflects the purity of his own mind. At this point, Shariputra, one of the Buddha's chief disciples, who is present in the assembly, is troubled by a thought. Why should the Buddha's own Buddha field be so impure? He even wonders whether it was because the Buddha's mind was impure when he created it. Reading his mind, the Buddha tells him that, just as the blind cannot see the sun and moon, however brightly they shine, so some beings cannot see the splendour of his Buddha land due to their spiritual blindness, their ignorance. The Buddha land is pure, but Shariputra cannot see it. The great god Shikin then joins in the conversation, asserting that he himself sees the Buddha land as equal in magnificence to the highest heavenly realms. Shariputra replies that he sees it with its highs and lows, its thorns, its precipices, its peaks, and its abysses, as if it were entirely filled with ordure. Shikin replies, "The fact that you see such a Buddha field as this, as if it were so impure, Reverend Sariputra, is a sure sign that there are highs and lows in your mind, and that your positive thought in regard to the Buddha gnosis is not pure either." As if to settle the matter, the Buddha touches the earth with his big toe, whereupon the whole universe is seen as a mass of sparkling jewels, and the entire assembly, including Shariputra, perceive themselves to be seated on thrones of jewelled lotuses. The Buddha explains to Shariputra that his Buddha field is always as pure as it now appears, but the Tathagata makes it appear to be spoiled by many faults in order to bring about the maturity of inferior living beings. Furthermore, he says that living beings born in the same Buddha field see the splendour of the virtues of the Buddha fields of the Buddhas according to their own degrees of purity. These two statements are, of course, contradictory. Do people see the purity or impurity of a Buddha field because of how the Buddha makes it appear, or according to their own degree of purity? Both, the text would have us believe. In a way, this contradiction runs throughout this particular aspect of the Mahayana. In the first case, the Buddha field objectively seems impure, and there is apparently no variation between the perceptions of the different beings who reside in it. To the extent that it is real as a creation, it really is an impure land. If it was unequivocally the case that the pure land consisted in the perception of the beings in it, that would imply that the Buddha creates the perceptions of other beings, which he does not. If he did, that would deprive them of all freedom and spiritual autonomy, whereas the implication of the second statement is that they have their own perceptions, which are not created by the Buddha. It is a sort of koan, perhaps intentionally so. We should not try to explain the contradiction away. We need to meet it head on and admit that there is a contradiction. We should reflect on it and meditate on it from both points of view and see whether that meditation results in a flash of insight which enables us to reconcile the opposites, to rise above the contradiction. It may feel rather unsatisfactory not to be able to answer the question, but in fact it is deeply satisfying to find a real contradiction in the Mahayana text, a contradiction which cannot be resolved just by looking up one or two words in the Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit dictionary, but has to be meditated upon. Having demonstrated the purity of the apparently impure Buddha field, the Buddha then returns the Buddha field to its usual state. As a result of all that has happened, the spiritual vision of large numbers of living beings is purified, and they attain various degrees of realization. And so the first chapter ends. It is possible that this chapter was originally a short, separate work incorporated into the Vimalakirti Nirdesha at some point in its development. No more is heard of Ratnakara, and Vimalakirti himself first appears at the beginning of the next chapter. Be that as it may, the chapter certainly constitutes an appropriate prologue to the main body of the text, setting the scene with its wonderful imagery and poetry, and its elements of magic and devotion. It also forms the background to the theme of the Buddha land, which we will now consider in more detail. We have already seen what a Buddha land is in terms of traditional Indian Buddhist cosmology. And we have also seen that the Buddha land does not just appear. It is brought into being, built even, by the Bodhisattva, who, in the course of his own spiritual evolution, sets up the ideal environment for the leading of the spiritual life. It is the Bodhisattva who purifies the Buddha land, as the text has it. Of course, a Buddha can create a pure land too, but generally it is a Bodhisattva who does so, and he does so in fulfilment of his vow to attain supreme perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. I have been referring to the Bodhisattva in the singular, but the text in fact suggests at several points that it is the Bodhisattvas, plural, who purify the Buddha land. So why is this? Can a Bodhisattva not manage to build a Buddha land on his own? Well, according to the Mahayana, an advanced Bodhisattva is quite capable of purifying or building the Buddha land single-handedly, just as a magician is capable of creating a magical elephant through his own power. But what would be the use? Yes, you can create a Buddha land and give people a glimpse of it. You may even be able to keep them in it for a little while. But you cannot keep them there indefinitely, not even if you are a Bodhisattva. This is because they are not going to cooperate, they are not going to want to stay there indefinitely, or even for very long, because they will not feel at home there. They are not ready for it. There's a little Indian story that illustrates this point, and it will perhaps bring us down to earth somewhat, but never mind. The story is about a woman who sold fish. She lived in a small village on the banks of a big Indian river, and every week she took her fish to the market in a big basket. Now one week, for some reason or other, it took her rather a long time to sell all her fish. She decided that rather than make her way back to the village so late at night, she had better stay in the town. Fortunately, she found a flower shop still open, and the flower seller was sympathetic to her plight, and said she could spend the night in his shop. Indian flower shops don't sell flowers in bunches as Western ones do. They sell sweet-smelling garlands, and little bunches of sweet-scented flowers for the ladies to put in their hair. The fish seller lay down to sleep among all those sweet-smelling flowers, but she tossed and turned and couldn't get to sleep. She couldn't bear the scent of the flowers. They were so sweet, so beautiful. In the end, she got her old fish basket, which of course smelled strongly of fish, and put it right next to her, right by her nose. After that, she slept quite soundly. We might laugh at the fish seller's plight, but we ourselves are in much the same position. She felt uncomfortable in the flower shop among all those sweet-smelling flowers, but we would feel no less uncomfortable in the Pure Land. We could manage a short visit, perhaps a weekend, but eventually we would want to introduce some equivalent of her smelly old fish basket into the Pure Land. we would want to bring along some physical or mental distraction. Perhaps our television set, our motorbike, our record collection, our lover, or our office files. Then we would feel more comfortable, more at home. But then, of course, the Pure Land would no longer be the Pure Land. So the Bodhisattva cannot keep people in the Buddha Land against their will. In any case, that would be a contradiction in terms, because the spiritual life is essentially the autonomous life, the free life, the emancipated life. So what is the Bodhisattva to do? He cannot create a Buddha Land by magical power and then hold people in it, at least not for very long. They will soon start getting uncomfortable, and then, no more Buddha Land. The answer is that the Buddha Land has to be a joint creation. It has to be built by a number of people, bodhisattvas and would-be bodhisattvas, working together. One of them may be more advanced than the others, may have more vision, may even be the first to attain enlightenment, and then help the others to take that final step. But all must be inspired by the same ideal, the ideal of supreme perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. They all therefore follow the Bodhisattva path, follow it for thousands of lives, and all follow it together. This is a truly wonderful conception. The whole spiritual community being born together as a spiritual community, living and working together, helping one another, life after life, until the Buddha Land is established. There is some reflection of this idea in the Pali Jataka stories, in which the Buddha's disciples, Ananda, Yashodhara, Sariputra, Mahakasapa, even Devadatta, are represented as having been associated with him in many previous existences. On a more mundane level, a remarkable book was published in England a few years ago, telling the story of a group of Cathars in southern France in the 13th century, who were said to have been reborn during the Napoleonic Wars, and again in the present century in Cornwall. In all these different lives, they have been in personal contact with one another, and have tried to help one another in their development. But why do the Bodhisattvas, build the Buddha Land? It would be easy to answer this question along straightforward traditional lines. We could say that the Bodhisattva wants to help others by providing them with an ideal environment in which to develop spiritually. This is quite correct as far as it goes, but it only raises a further question. Why should the Bodhisattva be concerned with others at all? To answer this, we have to go a little deeper. Should we devote ourselves to our own emancipation or to helping others? This question is crucial to the spiritual life. In the context of Buddhism, it amounts to asking whether we should follow the Arhat ideal or the Bodhisattva ideal, envisaging these two ideals in their extreme, even mutually exclusive forms. In its extreme form, the Arhat ideal is to gain an emancipation for oneself alone, without bothering too much about other people. The Bodhisattva ideal, on the contrary, is to help others to become free without bothering too much about oneself. But the two ideals are not as contradictory as they may seem. Indeed, they cannot really be separated. You cannot really help yourself without helping others, and you cannot really help others without helping yourself. We are social beings. I won't say essentially social beings, as this could be misunderstood to suggest that we have to have a social life. It is impossible to cut yourself off from other people for any length of time, even though you may cut yourself off from physical contact with them. You influence them. They influence you. If you develop emotional positivity, imagination, and insight within yourself, that has its effect on others. And if you work for others, give to others, sacrifice yourself for them, that has its effect on you. So we cannot really separate helping ourselves from helping others, certainly not in the spiritual sphere. The Arhat ideal and the Bodhisattva ideal are inseparable. Carried to their logical conclusion, each includes the other. The Bodhisattvas build the Buddha land because they have no alternative. If you want to evolve spiritually, you have to evolve in free association with others. Blake says, "Mutual forgiveness of each vice, such are the gates of paradise." Similarly, though less poetically, we could say, "Mutual helpfulness in leading the spiritual life, such is the foundation of the Buddha land." And what do the Bodhisattvas use to build the Buddha land? The Buddha himself answers this question in his reply to Ratnakara. "A Buddha field of Bodhisattvas is a field of living beings. A Buddha land is built with living beings, that is, with living beings who want to evolve. As Hakuin says in his Song of Meditation, outside living beings, no Buddhas. No living beings, no Buddha land. In short, if you want to build a Buddha land, you need people. In a sense, in fact, people are all that you need. It doesn't matter if you don't have buildings or money. If you've got people, you've got everything. And if you haven't got people, you haven't got anything. This is true not only in building the Buddha land, but at all levels of the spiritual life. If you want to have a spiritual community or a spiritual movement, you need people. If you want to hold a retreat or give a talk on Buddhism, you need people. It's not enough to have the facilities, not enough to have the teacher or the speaker. You need people. People who want to become true individuals, people who want to evolve. At the same time, we should not take this metaphor too literally. The Bodhisattva is not a sort of spiritual bricklayer, fitting people neatly into place with the aid of a bit of compassion for cement. People are not passive, people are not inert, people are not things. A Bodhisattva can build the Buddha land with people only with their cooperation, and cooperation means communication. So there is no question of the Bodhisattvas literally building the Buddha land with other people. In helping to build the Buddha land, the other people are themselves aspiring Bodhisattvas, so the Bodhisattvas really build the Buddha land with themselves. As to how the Bodhisattvas build the Buddha land, the Buddha answers this question too, when he says that a Bodhisattva's Buddha field is a field of positive thought, a field of high resolve, a field of virtuous application, a field of the six perfections, a field of the four immeasurables, friendliness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, a field of the ten precepts, and so on. Bodhisattvas build a Buddha field to the extent that they develop themselves spiritually, to the extent that they practice the Dharma for the benefit of all. They purify a Buddha field to the extent that they purify their own minds. Notice that the Buddha speaks of a Bodhisattva here. This reminds us that the Dharma is to be practiced by each of us individually, even though we practice in spiritual fellowship with others who are also practicing. The Buddha field, the Buddha land, is built by the Bodhisattva's united but individual practice of the Dharma. We have seen that the Buddha land is the ideal environment envisaged on a cosmic scale for the leading of the spiritual life. It is built by the united spiritual efforts of the Bodhisattvas, and they build it because, if they want to be Bodhisattvas at all, they have no choice. The spiritual development of one of them involves the spiritual development of all, and vice versa. The Bodhisattvas build the Buddha land with their own lives and by means of their individual practice of the Dharma within the context of spiritual fellowship. But in a way, this doesn't help us very much. It only leads to an even bigger question. What has all this to do with us? All the magic and splendour, all the deep metaphysical ideas, all the colour of this Mahayana Sutra, what has it to do with us? What have we to do with building the Buddha land? A Buddha land is, after all, something we can hardly imagine. It is built mainly by advanced bodhisattvas, beings we can hardly imagine, by means of a practice of the Dharma we can hardly imagine. So what has it all got to do with us? To answer this question, we have to come right down to earth. Or rather, we have only to come some way down to earth, because the question may be addressed, at least indirectly, by considering a field of human activity which, we may say, mediates between the world of higher spiritual values and mundane everyday existence. This is the field of art and creativity. One often hears people saying, perhaps sometimes apologetically, sometimes defiantly, sometimes wistfully, sometimes ironically, "I'm not very creative." What they usually mean by this is that they cannot paint pictures, write poetry, compose music, or throw pots. Artistic creativity seems to be in vogue these days. Everyone is supposed to be creative. But what do we mean by being creative? Is it just a matter of being able to paint pictures? Creativity involves a distinction between subject and object. On the one hand, there is you, the artist. On the other, the material out of which you create your work of art, as well as the idea in accordance with which you create it, an idea that may be more or less conscious. And the material out of which the artist creates may be of different kinds. There's the obvious physical stuff out of which a work is made, clay, paint, sound, language, or whatever. Then there's the involvement of the artist's own person, the voice, the physical body, the mental and emotional states. And other people also become artistic material, either as merely passive material for the artist's creativity, like a sculptor's model, or actively cooperating with it, themselves creative in relation to the artist's creativity, like an orchestra or a cast of actors. In the latter case, there is no absolute distinction between the artist and the material, the people, from which they create. Generally, we experience ourselves as subjects in relation to the object of the whole external world in the broadest sense. But we are not passive in relation to the external world. We do not merely register impressions. The world impinges on us, and we also impinge on the world, on our own environment, or a part of it. We impinge on our own selves, on ourselves considered as objects to ourselves, that is, considered reflexively. And we also impinge on other people. Not only do we impinge on the world, we affect it in various ways. We alter it, we arrange it, we rearrange it, at least to some extent, however slight. And not only that, there is a pattern to the way in which we impinge on the world. We don't impinge on it at random, but in accordance with a certain idea, a certain pattern, image, gestalt, or myth within ourselves, even, we could say, a pattern which is ourselves. It is rare for us consciously to realize this, but what it means is that our relationship with the world is essentially creative. We are creating all the time. Creativity is not limited to the exercise of the fine arts. Everyone is creative. It is only a question of the quality of our creativity, greater or lesser success, greater or lesser clarity, greater or lesser positivity. We are creative when we speak, when we decorate a room, when we write a letter. This is the basic principle of what we may call applied Zen. Zen applied to the art of living itself. Zen is a well-known example of the application of spiritual realization to various otherwise mundane activities in such a way as to bring them into harmony with that realization. In this way, Zen is applied to architecture, to landscape gardening, to archery or swordsmanship, to flower arrangement, and to everyday manners and customs. The Zen approach, in which the human subject is creative in relation to its object, is akin to the building of the Buddha land, in that it transforms various aspects of the world. The extent to which it is possible to bring about such a transformation will depend on all sorts of factors: the material resources that are available to you, the nature of the environment, the degree of cooperation that you get from other people, and so on. Suppose, for instance, you want to apply the principle of Zen to the surrounding landscape. It doesn't depend just on your own personal inspiration or realization. You need the cooperation of other people, because they have as much responsibility for the environment as you. But in principle, there is no reason why it shouldn't be possible to express your creativity in this large-scale way. It depends not only on how deep your meditation practice is, but on other quite mundane factors, even on worldly power. In the past, kings and emperors who have been sympathetic to Chan or Zen have been able to order the construction of many Zen-type gardens and buildings. It is not either that your creativity always needs to take a particular kind of formal expression, but it always takes some kind of formal expression. The expression has to take a particular form, whether it be that of painting or poetry, architecture or landscape gardening, archery or flower arranging. If you don't have the power to construct a Zen temple, you can at least paint your room, or even just tidy it up. The way you eat your food, the way you set out your dishes, even the way you do the washing up, all these can be the application of Zen to the art of living. Art is a particularly appropriate analogy for the creation of a Buddha land, because it involves giving a harmonious external embodiment to an idea, which is what, in a very much higher sense, a Buddha or a Bodhisattva does when he sets about building a Buddha land. A Buddha land is a sort of work of art. But the principle operates in everybody's life all the time, not just in the life of the artist, because all the time we all have an influence on our environment. We interact with the world, and that interaction can be negative and destructive, or positive and creative. It is the positive, creative kind of interaction with the world to which especially we give the name art. Another close analogy to building a Buddha land is the art of statesmanship. The laying down of laws which make possible the development of a positive and harmonious society is certainly one of the arts, in the broader sense in which we have defined the term. The lawgiver impinges on the world in accordance with a certain idea, a certain pattern, which he usually quite consciously realizes. One could therefore regard great statesmen and leaders as being essentially creative or as exercising a specifically creative function. In most cases throughout history, the masses have been relatively passive and their leaders have just issued orders sanctioned by force and fear. These situations have not therefore given the statesman the opportunity to practice the highest form of such creativity. You could practice this only if you could enlist people's willing cooperation in the formation and enactment of laws and the creation of the kind of society that those laws made possible. Statesmen, whether individually or collectively, can certainly change society. Whether they change it positively or in a genuinely creative manner is, of course, quite a different question. But we could speak of Zen and the art of statesmanship. In Buddhist tradition, the Chakravartin Raja, the wheel-turning king, is ranked second only to the Buddha. Had the Buddha himself not decided to become a Buddha, tradition has it that he would have become a Chakravartin Raja. We are told quite specifically that the principal function of a Chakravartin Raja is to create or maintain a society in which the 10 Akusala Dharmas are banished and the practice of the 10 Kusala Dharmas, 10 precepts, is encouraged. We could say that the Buddha works on a restricted section of society, primarily on the Sangha, but the Chakravartin Raja works on society as a whole, without, of course, being enlightened in the way that the Buddha is. We should not, however, confuse the essentially mundane activity of the Chakravartin Raja with, say, Amitabha's creation of Sukhavati. At the very least, Sukhavati is a transfigured material world, whereas the world of the Chakravartin Raja is definitely the ordinary workaday world of society, economics, politics, ethics, and so on, the world of government in the ordinary sense. But the ruler performs essentially the same function, or engages in essentially the same type of activity as the artist. His task may be more difficult because he is having to deal with human beings rather than inert materials. It is comparatively easy to manipulate pigments and marble and words, but to create a particular kind of society by organizing the activities of human beings without restricting their freedom is extremely difficult. In fact, you would have to be something of a saint to succeed. People sometimes complain about organizations in the state without really considering what a difficult task government must be. Ideally, of course, there would be no need for government because we would all take responsibility for ourselves. If our relation to the world is essentially creative, the notable conclusion that follows is that the world, is our creation. We create the world we live in. There is no question, therefore, of whether or not we should be creative, or whether or not we should create a world. We have no choice. The only choice we have is what kind of world we create. The Tibetan Wheel of Life depicts 6 realms of existence which illustrate the kinds of worlds we can create for ourselves. We can create a world of the gods, a world of refined, sensuous, intellectual, aesthetic, but rather selfish, self-indulgent pleasure, or a world of human beings, a world of ordinary domestic, civic, political, and cultural obligations and activities. We can create a world of asuras or anti-gods, a world of jealousy, excessive sexual polarization, over-aggressiveness, ruthless competition, and overt or covert conflict, or a world of hungry ghosts, a world of neurotic craving, intense possessiveness, and relationships characterized by extreme emotional dependence. We can create a world of tormented beings, a world of pain and suffering, of intense physical and mental distress, or a world of animals, a world of straightforward food, sex, and sleep. Or, turning our back on all these, we can devote ourselves to developing as individuals. We can devote ourselves to the Bodhisattva ideal. We can devote ourselves, directly or indirectly, to building the Buddha land. Turning our back on the wheel of life altogether, we can begin to tread the spiral path that leads to enlightenment. We can devote ourselves to developing as individuals, to the Bodhisattva ideal. And in so doing, we choose to create another kind of world. In other words, we devote ourselves, directly or indirectly, to building the Buddha land.